Welcome to this latest edition of The Elephant in the Room. And today it is my singular pleasure to welcome Ms. Reem Abbas from Khartoum. Reem is a journalist and a communication professional. Welcome, Reem. How are people coping?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be in The Elephant. I think it's definitely very unfortunate because we just completed 1 year, like our first year of the transitional period, and it's been just one crisis after another. We have so many priorities and ambitions for this transitional period, but with COVID and now the flooding situation in Sudan, I think a lot of people are thinking that we are just a very unlucky country, but we just have to persevere and we just have to continue building.
If I can ask you know a question, one of the unique things about the process that led to the removal of the long-time dictator of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, in 2019. Was demonstrations that were overwhelmingly led by women, especially from 2018. 60 to 70% of the demonstrators were women. And there's this iconic picture of Miss Ala Sala that became the icon of the changes that were happening in Sudan. And I just wanted to ask you to give us a bit of background about this rather unique and heavy involvement of women in bringing about change in Sudan.
I think it was not very unusual to have this large number of women present in the protest, basically in the protest movement in Sudan, because women were always on the front lines of the movement against the government since the 1989 coup. And this is why they always faced discriminatory laws, they always faced detention, they always faced a lot of policies basically that were meant to intimidate them into silence, because they were always the ones really on the front lines at all events. During the revolution, women were on the streets, but they also presented a very big important dynamic of the revolutionary infrastructure. So from distributing flyers to organizing neighborhood-based protests to also organizing people at the neighborhood level, building different, field clinics, building different about what's happening. So I think women presented a very important part of this revolutionary infrastructure. But a lot of us feel used, after the revolution, because I think during the heat of the moment, we forgot that, or we did not forget, but we worked as if the political parties and the movements and all the political infrastructure in Sudan and the landscape is not patriarchal. It is very much patriarchal. It is very much, deeply rooted in this understanding that the political elite are always, men from very specific parts of Sudan, from, a very particular middle class, upbringing and a very particular education at very particular schools. So I think they reject anything. They reject women, they reject young people, they reject religious minorities, they reject people from other regions of Sudan. So I think it's a very much exclusive, political landscape that we have to continue to fight, basically, to break it down and to make him. And this will take a lot of work from us. So the revolution for us is not over.
Tell me about Girifna. What is Girifna?
Yes. Girifna means we're fed up.
It means?
We're disgusted. I mean, some people translated it. Three, Girifna means we're fed up or we're disgusted, absolute disgust. So in 2009, three friends, decided that they want to make sure that, the NCP, the National Congress Party, Omar al-Bashir's party, does not win the 2010 elections. So they decided to start this, youth movement, basically, and to campaign against the National Congress Party. So in the first few days when they started, they were distributing hundreds of thousands of flyers, against the NCP. So Girifna was a movement that was born because people were tired, especially young people were tired and sick of the political parties. And because there was political stagnation on the side of the government and on the side of the opposition forces, and young people felt that they don't want what's happening. They want to mobilize and they want to oppose what's happening, but on their own terms. So Gerifna was born as a movement that allows this kind of creativity. So young people go into the market and talking about corruption and talking about conflict, you know, and then running from the police and the national security, you know, distributing flyers, songs, you know, we had rap songs, for example, we had different social media stunts that were happening, very active social media presence, graffiti, you know, all over the city. So Gerifna was basically a movement that was born out of creativity and out of a need to have some kind of change. So I joined Gerifna in 2011 because I wanted, because, I mean, as a journalist at the time in Sudan, I was a cultural journalist, but in Sudan, you really can't, everything you do is political. So I was writing about culture, and then I want to interview a writer, and the writer basically, I found out that his books are banned, and I have to buy them from like the back of a truck, you know, in a deal that kind of seemed as if I was buying drugs, right? And so I went go to a fashion show to cover a fashion show, and then it gets raided by the morality police, and everyone is arrested and in like trials for a month. So I got to a point where I said, what am I doing? You know, I need to be part of something that represents me, because I felt that I, even as a journalist, I can't even work if there's no political change. I mean, I am just kind of, I'm going in circles and I can't even do anything, right? So I joined Gerifna in 2011 because it was the right space for me, because I was also sick and tired of the different parties that were very stagnant and that were very, you know, very much, marginalizing women and youth and so on. So in Gerifna, we were all, most of us were young people, you know, in our 20s, you know, we did different movements. So our color was orange, for example, the movement's main color was orange. So we used to print, you know, different newsletters, and we used to print flyers on orange colored paper. So at some point, the national security confiscated all orange colored papers, like A4 papers in the whole country, you know, in like the whole capital, because they didn't want us to print, you know, on orange colored papers. So I think like Gerifna is one of the movements that really inspired young people at the time. Of course, it was heavily, you know, the crackdown was like very bad. I mean, the crackdown, we've lost a lot of members they had to leave the country. We've had one of our members was arrested in 2011, and she was, you know, gang raped by the national security. And just so many, it was very difficult. I mean, it was just very difficult for us to remain, you know, active, because you just, you know, they come at you so many ways. You get arrested, or you could lose your job, your livelihood. No one wants to hire you, or they fail you in college and you never get to graduate. So just, they come to you in so many different ways that it's so difficult to you know, to stay positive. It's so difficult to stay connected. So, and at some point, I mean, I really just used to think that maybe we are crazy, you know, maybe the people of Sudan love the government of Omar al-Bashir and we're just a bunch of lunatics, you know, because you get to a point where you really feel that, you know, you're screaming and you're doing so much and, you know, you're putting so much and investing a lot of your energy and you're putting your security at risk, and no one is really, you know, no one is doing the same, or like people are not listening. Or, you know, you're giving a talk in the market and then just average people call the security to arrest you. So I think you just feel that, I mean, why is this happening? You know, why is this happening to us? But yeah, but so Gerifna was, I think, a very good experiment. It was a movement that was, you know, very creative. It was a movement that was very grassroots. It was a movement that managed to reach people in different parts in Sudan. I mean, at some point their flyers reached, you know, Sudanese, you know, refugee camps where Sudanese refugees are basically being, you know, are settling in Chad and so on. So this was, I would say, I mean, the revolution in Sudan did not start in 2018. It started a very long time ago. And I think this is the kind of the infrastructure that was setting the ground. The armed groups and Girifna and so many different infrastructures were being built basically by revolutionaries for many years before the revolution happened.
It seems slightly counterintuitive that the Bashir government was one that was supported by the Islamist party, and going back to Mr. Al-Turabi, etc. And of course, women's role in society and in politics and the economy under Sharia was constrained more than it was before. Yet women were at the forefront of the changes that you're talking about. How did that come to be? Where did people like Reem find the courage? Because you're not only going up against the system, but it's been codified now into Sharia and women's places. People try to pigeonhole women into particular small boxes, but here we have women at the forefront through Girifna and up to 2019.
I mean, I think women had to be a very important component of the revolution exactly for this reason, because we were criminalized, basically. Our presence was criminalized on the streets, in the private spaces. Our behavior was criminalized, our dress code was criminalized. So the minute you leave your house, you know, you could get arrested for dressing, because, I mean, the law was called indecent clothing. So no one really knows what indecent clothing is, right? Something very vague, something up to the interpretation of the arresting officer. So you get arrested for indecent clothing. You could get arrested for indecent behavior. And those are discriminatory that disproportionately targeted women. So you're criminal in the private spaces also, like all the laws that were like family law, for example, the personal status laws, it really degraded women, you know, to it was just very, very difficult for women to get any kind of rights. I mean, it made child marriage okay. So everything that basically degraded women was actually very much appreciated, and it was actually in the law. And and the law was used as a tool to oppress women and criminalize them. So you had the whole state basically was functioning on this pretext, basically, that women should not be on the streets. And when they're on the streets, you have to basically intimidate them into going back to their houses. When they're in their houses, you have to use laws to make sure that they are obeying the society, obeying the cultural norms, and so on. So, and we kept fighting. I mean, it's not easy, but we kept fighting. So every year, thousands of women would get arrested for indecent clothing, for indecent behavior. They would get lashed, intimidated, and they would get fined, you know, but they would still continue fighting, you know? So just, and everything just becomes difficult. I remember I used to work in at the university at some point, and, you know, I think a lot of, like, and the way I was treated and so many of my other colleagues were treated were really just based on how you dress. So if you dress a certain way, then, for example, they would tell you, oh, we're not going to help you because you have to dress a certain way. Oh, you know, your salary is late, you know, this, a lot of things. So they do a lot of things to basically to make life very difficult for you, you know. So you wake up one day and you're like, you know what, I am going to abide by your laws because I am tired, you know. And I think this is what a lot of women did because they were just exhausted. So, but I think also I have to talk about my privilege, because I think as a woman, you know, from the northern part of Sudan, from, you know, one of the dominant tribes, from, you know, a middle class, you know, or upper middle class upbringing, you know, so with, you know, a certain level of education and access, I think I also felt protected, you know, from the system. And I felt that I was better off from other women who are, you know, from poor backgrounds, from, you know, specific regions of Sudan, even like, you know, religious minorities and so many other women. So I felt protected and I felt that I was able to challenge, you know, police officers. I was able to challenge the law because of this kind of, you know, this kind of like privilege I had. And I used this, you know, I used it because I felt that I can stand up for the system as opposed to other women who can't, basically.
Great. There was Girifna, and now what we read about is the forces for freedom and change, as the movement. Can you just give me a bit of your perspective on the forces for freedom and change and how that came about and its role in the transition that took place in 2019?
Okay, great. So. In Sudan, protests began in Demazin, Blue Nile State, in the 13th of December, 2018. So at that time, this, a body calling itself the Sudanese Professionals Association, which is like a coalition of like trade unions, were basically say, you know, of like, you know, teachers, committees, and so on, but trade unions that were independent, okay, because we also had government trade unions. So those were like independent trade unions that came together and said, we want to march to the parliament and we are going to submit a memorandum calling for, you know, basically that asking the government to lift the minimum wage, you know, because at the time it was absolutely ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So they did the research, and based on this research, they decided that, okay, this should be the minimum wage for, you know, Sudanese families. So this SPA was working on this issue. And then when the protests started in Demazin and in Gadarif and in Adbara, they felt that, okay, the Sudanese people do not want a minimum wage. They want the political change, you know? So the stakes are higher and people's ambitions are different. Yeah. So the SPA said, we are calling for a march to the to the presidential palace on the 25th of December 2018 to ask Omar al-Bashir to step down, because this is what the people want. So when the protest was, you know, a lot of people turned up because I think everyone wanted change, but like they were waiting for other people, right? Everyone was waiting for the other person to say, let's go, let's do it, you know? So when people actually turned up and it was really a very big crowd, the SPA and political parties and civil society started saying, okay, what's happening? Let's do something about this. So they started speaking, and then there was a document that was drafted earlier by the civil society. And this document was basically, they worked on it a little bit, the political parties, the SPA and the civil society, and they turned it into a document that came to be known as the as the Declaration on Freedom of Freedom and Change, okay? So this declaration was basically by late December, it was actually in the picture, and then political parties started signing, political coalitions started signing, civil society started signing the declaration, the SPA signed the declaration. So the freedom and change, the forces for freedom and change are actually the forces that signed the declaration, you know, on freedom and change, basically, okay? So right now, the FFC, we call them the FFC, are basically, they have different components, and one of them is civil society, something called the civil society forces. They also have the Sudan Call components, they have the Democratic Unionist component, they have the National Consensus Forces component. So right now, it is made up of civil society, the SPA, and political parties. But of course, political parties have, you know, greater weight, like they say. So basically this is the FFC.
Thank you. If I can ask, I mean, we now have a sort of transitional government that is in place. Yet in March this year, there was an assassination attempt against Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok. And one notices some of the key generals in intelligence and other places remain very much still very key figures in governance in Sudan. So I just wanted you just to give me some highlights of you know, of how the progressive forces in Sudan are managing a situation where you had a very well entrenched military regime that was in power for decades, has now been, you know, the leadership has been removed, but some of its key players, both in the military, the security, but also in the business community, what I'm hearing Sudanese call the deep state, remains very strong. And I just wanted you to give me your perspective on that and you know, its prospects.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, just so I can explain something, you know, when the NCP came to power in 1989, they basically started sacking up to 120,000 civil servants.
Okay.
So basically anyone who is not Islamist or anyone who they thought they would be unable to control, they sacked them to the public good. So they brought their people to occupy all the different, you know, positions. So when I talk about the deep state in Sudan, it's very entrenched. I mean, the Islamists controlled everything from the locality to the popular committees at the neighborhood level to all the different, you know, top positions, basically. But yeah, so I want to go back to your question about the you know, the deep state and the assassination attempt on Hamdok's life earlier this year. I mean, I think, to be honest, I predicted this. I mean, ever since the transitional government came to power, I did predict that the transitional period would witness violence, because the Islamists are very violent, okay? And the NCP were a very violent, you know, regime. And they also have a lot of weapons. I mean, all their members, you know, have arms, and they are, or the members that they have been recruiting, many of them, you know, fought in the jihad, you know, the holy war in South Sudan. Mm-hmm. So their mentality, you know, it's the jihad mentality. And this mentality is very much entrenched within all the different ranks of their membership.
Yes.
So I did expect to see violence during the transitional period.
Yes.
And until
yes.
now, I mean, I think we are still going to experience more volatility in the upcoming month. I mean, another thing is, the Islamists used to constitutionalist, you know, and Sudan has a constituency because, I mean, Sudan welcomed, embraced, and so many fundamentalists from the region, all the fundamentalists in the world, and I'm talking about religious fundamentalists, used to come to Sudan to get trained and to live and to have, to, you know, organize businesses and so on. So those people are not very happy about what's happening. They feel, and what they keep repeating is that this government is a communist, secular government that they are against, you know. So I do feel that this is a situation that we have to deal with, and this is a battle that we have to deal with sooner or later. So I do expect the transitional period to be volatile because of those, like, different forces. When we look at the I mean, the like intelligence, you know, the national intelligence, when we look at, you know, their role, basically, security sector reform has been non-existent, basically. So since the transitional government came to power, the security sector has not been reformed. The police has not been reformed. I mean, they have recycled some figures, actually, who were, you know, very much parts of the old regime. So, and the security sector reform is very, very difficult. And it's a very, very difficult process because, I mean, in Sudan, we do have a situation where we have the military establishment and we have the security sector, and they were very important pillars of the rule of Omar al-Bashir. The military, when I say the military establishment, I'm talking about the military, I'm talking about their businesses and how they control a very large sector of the economy. And I'm talking about how they have always controlled they have basically controlled the country for since independence, okay? Except for a few years. So to remove the military is not, it's not easy. I mean, you have to start breaking the establishment. You have to start basically reclaiming the resources that they have invested in their own, you know, businesses for the last decades. And this is something that Hamdok's government has not done right now, or has they have not done in the past year. The security sector, the same. The security sector is very wealthy. They have businesses, they have a lot of like perks and privilege. So they're just not going to, you know, hand over this to the civilian, you know, to civilian rule, right? And also we do have a problem. I mean, the ICC, you know, like justice is a very important file. So, and a lot of our security and military generals are like, are basically, they were caught red-handed, you know? I mean, it's either they have files at the ICC or they are actually, or they are going to basically, come up in different investigations inside Sudan. So they are also very much unwilling to hand over any kind of resource or power because they don't feel secure. And rightly so, they should not feel secure because they should not get away with what they have done. So this makes a situation very complicated. And this really brings us to the core problem, which is the Constitutional Declaration. Yes. You know, the African Union, they pushed, I mean, the international community pushed very hard for Sudan to reach a deal, for a deal to happen in Sudan. And I think this was, and the way this was orchestrated and the way this was done really created a document that has a lot of flaws. It created a document that does not match the standards of the people of Sudan. And we are seeing the repercussions right now of this like flawed documents and how it's not holding up and during the transitional period.
Just to tap into just, I mean, everyone has heard about this rapid support forces, this militia led by this gentleman, Mr. Hemeti, I think is his nom de guerre. They remain still quite present in Sudanese governance. Yet this is not officially a part of the military, or you know, and how is that being handled? And yet it's that group which has been associated with some of the worst excesses in places like Darfur, etc. But they remain very much a feature of political life in Sudan.
Yes. So so before the RSF, there was something called the Janjaweed, and we've heard about this in the early days of the Darfur conflict, you know, men on horseback.
Yes.
So the Janjaweed were led by a man called Musa Hilal. Musa Hilal is actually related to Hemeti. He's related to Hamdan Daglu or Hemeti.
Okay.
So Musa Hilal started falling out of the government of Sudan, you know, over resources, over, he wanted more power, basically, and more resources.
Yes.
So, and at the time, Hemeti was working with him. So Hemeti was part of the Janjaweed. So Bashir saw, I think, in something in Hemeti, because, I mean, he was a leader at the time, was successful. He managed his units very well. So I think the RSF is basically the developed, I would say, Janjaweed, you know, but they're just more advanced. They have better equipment instead of, you know, horses, basically, they have 4x4, okay? And so the Janjaweed, or the RSF came at a very important time, right? I mean, so Bashir used to do something very, very important. He wanted to protect himself, right, against a coup d'etat.
Yeah.
So he basically broke down the military. So you had the military, and then you had the Janjaweed as a militia. You had the border guards, and then you had the popular defense forces. So you had so many different like military, paramilitary units, you know? And so he basically broke down, you know, the military into different factions and different, I would say, even, you know, paramilitary like militias and so on. And this was on purpose, right? And so, and at the same time, the military itself, the Sudan armed forces were exhausted after years of fighting very complicated and endless wars, okay? So the RSF the RSF became strong and became very important because they're a militia, so they're able to do any kind of work. They move fast, you know. The recruitment is like, you know, young men, they don't, I mean, this is not the military, so the military usually moves slower. This moves very fast, the militia, and at the same time, the armed groups in 2011 organized under an umbrella called the Sudan Revolutionary Front. So they started fighting together, and by working together, they began to like hold more territory and win more battles. So the RSF had to come into the picture because they were ruthless. And that was, I think, the exact point, to have something that's so ruthless that can fight the RSF. And like in retrospect, you know, for Bashir and his government, they did a very good job. I mean, the RSF burned villages, they invaded so many places, they killed a lot of people, and they were very, very much ruthless, okay? And I think that was the whole point, you know? So they managed to basically, I wouldn't say stop, but they managed to control the insurgency that was happening. I mean, this is the word the government used to use, insurgency, that was happening in Darfur in 2012 and 2013. And the RSF even started to get weakened, you know, by 2013, 2014, because of the RSF. So this is Hamdan. So Hamdan Daglor Hemeti, a lot of people, I think, underestimated him, including Bashir. So, I mean, Bashir used to call him, you know, Himati, or my protection. So he saw him as his, like, personal protector. And so when the protests began, you know, he asked the RSF to come to Khartoum because, of course, I mean, he wanted to have this, like, you know, ruthless men on the streets, you know, who are basically able to come in and really crack down on the protest. But Hemeti became one of the cards, actually, that were used against al-Bashir, you know, and he maneuvered until he became part of the you know, and he maneuvered until he sat down with the military generals on the same table and became part of the process, you know. He's definitely very cunning, very smart, but at the same time, right now, I mean, this is my own analysis, I find it a very interesting situation because right now, you do find that some of the army generals are in line with the deep state, are in line with the NCP, you know, because they still have interests. They have vested interests together. Hemeti knows that if the NCP comes back, he is going to be killed, basically, okay? Because he is definitely, he's very much involved in purging the deep state, okay? So right now, his interest is actually to work with the FFC. Okay, but at the same time, Hemeti has political interest, and Hemeti is very much wanted because he committed atrocities in Darfur, and Hemeti committed atrocities in Khartoum on June 3rd. So it's a very, you know, complicated situation, you know. So the question right now that we're asking every day is, how do you accommodate Hemeti? How do you accommodate him, and how do you deal with him, basically? Yeah. And it's not easy because at the end of the day, this guy is—he managed to recruit, you know, thousands of young men because they're in godforsaken land, you know, and they don't have access to any development infrastructure. So basically, like, accommodating Hemeti is not only a political issue; it's not only a security issue; it's also a development issue. So it's not an easy question, but I think this is what I have to say about the RSF.
Last but not least, I just wanted to ask your perspective on regional and international players in the Sudanese situation. You know, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Qatar, US, Ethiopia, you know, there are a whole range of actors who have gotten engaged in the Sudanese situation and sometimes taking different positions. What is your perspective with regard to these international actors and their involvement in Sudanese political and economic affairs?
I think they're very problematic, especially the Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE axis. Very, very problematic because they basically don't want a democratic transition in Sudan, and they have made this very clear. I mean, they were pressured by the international community and by the friends of Sudan, you know, Europe and the US, to push the military into a deal last year. Yes. But their interest lies in not having a democratic transition in Sudan, and the scenario that they want is a Sisi-like situation where there is al-Burhan and he takes over and it becomes a military and a dictatorship, but a secular military dictatorship because they don't want the Islamists to come back. So this is their ideal situation. And they're doing this by really, I think, undermining the transitional period. I mean, we are seeing a huge economic situation where in the past few days, we've seen the Sudanese pound plummet, you know? And when I say plummet, I mean plummet. I mean, it was losing its value by the hour. And a lot of experts are saying that this is definitely one of the way the region is meddling, you know, that to really, you know, make sure that the transitional government is in such a difficult situation where, I mean, you have the floods and we've already lost a lot of crops. And then you have this economic situation where, you know, the SDEG is plummeting to the extent that some factories have stopped working because they don't know how to, like, what price to set. Basically, a lot of businesses have shut down because they don't know how to set prices anymore. So you have the situation where it's a crisis, you know, people were lining up to get fuel, you know, it's a very difficult situation. So they are basically like strangling, you know, they're strangling us, and or they are contributing to strangling us. Okay. Mm-hmm. Another issue that like many people have talked to believe that they're also involved is the ongoing conflict in Eastern Sudan. So Eastern Sudan, which was, you know, basically, which was not very much, we didn't really see a lot of clashes in Eastern Sudan. Since last year, we are seeing regular ethnic clashes that are sometimes, and most times actually deadly in Eastern Sudan. I mean, we've seen horrible situations in Port Sudan. And when you try to understand the history, the historical, you know, context of the conflict, it's not much is there, right? I mean, this is a very recent conflict. Yes. In Kassala, we are also seeing this polarization, political polarization in Kassala, and ethnic polarization that was fatal, actually. So they are doing so many, I think they're definitely meddling in so many ways to really abort any kind of transition in Sudan. And the transition is already difficult. I mean, we already have a civil government that is very much, it doesn't have resources. We have a civil government that is also not functioning very well. We have so many different challenges, you know. We have a peace process, a peace document that was just signed that is very delicate and needs a lot of attention and resources. So it is a very difficult situation, and I think they're making it more difficult, you know. And one of the very important slogans that was said during the revolution is victory or Egypt.
No.
And I think people really meant it. You know, people understood that the Egyptian people gave so much and fought so hard for them to get what their terrible dictatorship that is basically like putting them, that basically that is putting them through hell every day. So it's victory or Egypt, basically, for us.
One final question. Reem, is, you know, what's your vision in terms of what are the prospects for Sudan? Is it very, very delicate transition? The deep state remains very strong. You have these international actors who are interfering. You have a terrible economic situation. But there are still people like yourself who are pushing very hard for positive change. If you were to tell me, just to hazard a guess, what will the next, say, 12 to 18 months in Sudan look like, given all that is going on? What are the prospects?
Yes, I think we are quickly realizing that we know how to resist, we know how to fight, but we don't know how to build. Because right now, I think even as civil society, as actors, we've been stuck since the revolution, right? So now that, you know, we had the common enemy, that now there's so many different enemies. So I feel that the really, it lies within us as Sudanese people to really figure out what we want to do and to come together and figure out how we want to move forward. Because right now, I think it has just, the situation has been very polarizing. I mean, it's a very sort of polarized situation where people are unable to work together, where there are a lot of different, like, you know, factionism, and there are a lot of, like, you know, different movements splitting up and so on. And I think this is, and sometimes this is not all bad. I mean, this, because we have not really lived democracy. We don't know what democracy is. We don't know how to operate in a democratic way. We don't know how to basically enjoy freedom of speech. We don't know how to. So I think right now we're just learning this. And because this is very much new to us, we're finding it very, very difficult. So I think we have to just work together. And I think we have to work on strengthening our civil society and political parties. I think at the same time, we also have to continue holding the government accountable. And I think this is what I really like right now. We are literally on their backs, you know, and people, because at the end of the day, they were people, you know, who we knew, and they're in the civil society. People are attacking them on social media. They're going to their offices. They're standing in front of their offices. They're protesting, right? And because we do know that, like, we're expecting a lot from them. And a lot of people are willing to help. And a lot of people have returned back to Sudan to work for, you know, very little money or almost for free because they want to support the transitional government. But we have to hold them accountable, because we have, I want to say also, is that we're not getting a lot of follow-up and support from the African Union and different African countries. I mean, I think the African Union has just kind of like went on holiday after the constitutional declaration, and they're not really like staying up to date and with what's happening in Sudan, and even actually the regional bodies, the IGAD. So they have a responsibility, you know, they have a responsibility to follow up, to understand what's happening, and to pressure and to act, you know. They also have a responsibility to also help us fight the regional powers, to help us fight, you know, the international, you know, the different international dynamics that are trying to shackle us, basically, you know. So I think we have to think as Africans that whatever is happening in another African country is also our problem.